loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker. Talks begin today in the renegotiation of NAFTA, the North Atlantic Free Trade Agreement. An angry Donald Trump just dissolved his own major manufacturing councils after the CEOs distanced themselves from the president over his comments on white supremacy and Charlottesville. What's at stake? California became the first state to sue the Trump administration over its policy on sanctuary cities this past weekend. More lawsuits are sure to come. Yes, Donald Trump has now openly defended the white supremacists, some of whom he says are, quote, very fine people, close quote, attacking what he calls the alt-left. Meanwhile, a wave of protests sweeps the country against Confederate monuments, leading to their removal in the city of Baltimore. But first we turn to NAFTA. The talks for the renegotiation of NAFTA, the North Atlantic Free Trade Agreement, began today. Donald Trump campaigned against NAFTA, saying it harms U.S. workers. We are joined from San Francisco by Daniel Sankey, a financial policy analyst, and we're joined from London by Steve Keen. He's the author of Debunking Economics and the world's first crowdfunded economist. You can check out his work at patreon.com/profSteveKeen. Welcome back, Daniel and Steve.
Thanks for having me.
Glad to be here.
Thank you. I want to start by playing an audio clip of our president, Donald Trump. This was before he was our president. It was during the September 26th presidential debate. Let's listen.
And I have
your husband signed NAFTA, which was one of the worst things that ever happened to the manufacturing industry.
That is your opinion.
You go to New England, you go to Ohio, Pennsylvania, you go anywhere you want, Secretary Clinton, and you will see devastation where manufacturing is down 30, 40, sometimes 50%. NAFTA is the worst trade deal maybe ever signed anywhere, but certainly ever signed in this country.
Okay. Steve Keen, is he right?
He's right about the relocation of manufacturing. This has been a major trend for the last 30 or 40 years in mainstream economics, and there, by definition, almost the Democratic Party as well, has ignored this shift. So what's actually happened is by cutting, by making trade easier between third world countries and developed countries like the United States, because particularly United States corporations have relocated a lot of their manufacturing to the, take advantage of the lower wages and then export back to the American market where they end up selling those goods. And consequently, there's a higher profit for capitalists and lower wages for workers. And of course, the wages have been relocated from America to Mexico. So in that sense, he's tapping into a very genuine phenomenon of relocation of production by transnationals. And that does appeal to his working class base. Well, let's face it, after today, he's lost his CEO base, so we better work on the working class.
Yeah, okay. Daniel Sankey, let me ask you, in fact, the same question. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think Professor Keen is more or less correct. He has tapped into a justified current of anger in working class people in the manufacturing industry who have seen the relocation of this entire sector. Well, not the entire, but the vast majority of the sector to different countries. And so this has devastated a whole, communities of people in whole states who have relied on that sector to provide jobs and income for their families and for housing and for everything else. And so it makes sense that these people would be angry. Washington prior to Trump was pretty univocal that NAFTA and free trade was a good thing. There was very little criticizing it. And now, someone that's become mainstream like Trump is tapping into that anger and saying, no, absolutely not. And so it makes sense that this base would respond to that because it is, at least as far as the clip is concerned, his analysis is correct. Now, we'll talk in more detail because it's much more complex than that. But people are justifiably angry.
Right. People are justifiably angry. We know that the industrial sector has been diminished, not for the capitalists, because they've gone overseas, they're making lots of profits, but for workers and communities. Many communities have been completely devastated as big industrial firms go overseas or go to the South. But what, Steve Keen, is actually going to be up for renegotiation with this treaty, with these treaty negotiations?
You're right that Trump has identified a genuine symptom that American working class people are feeling. But of course, it isn't American working class who've negotiated what the terms of the discussion are going to be in the government-level discussions between Canada, America, and Mexico. And in fact, what's actually turned up in that is the usual sort of story, trying to extend trade even further. And in the American case, a large thing they're arguing for is what they failed to get with the TPP, which is the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, which is extending the capacity of corporations to sue governments when the policies infringe the potential profitability of the corporations, even if that involves, for example, selling tobacco into the third world. So a large part of what's being put up in negotiation is the exact opposite of the sort of thing that working class Americans would want to see actually being negotiated in their favour. They want to see things which actually make it harder for corporations to move production overseas and reduce the power of corporations. The actual terms of what's being put forward for the NAFTA renegotiations are to increase the power of corporations. So now it's going to be intriguing to see which way Trump actually falls when it comes to a choice between power and his base.
Daniel Sankey, can you help us fill in some of the details of what that might look like and where you think Trump will end?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think part of the problem is the whole premise of NAFTA is empowering corporations and giving them special rights and privileges between different countries. So the idea that somehow this document can be utilized in a way that will benefit working class people is just, you know, ridiculous. So, there's a lot of different examples. It's an incredibly complex document, but I think one of the most telling, for example, is, you know, involving corn, which was a major, Mexico was a major producer of it. And in part, they protected their corn industry by having tariffs so the United States couldn't flood the market with corn, and which they could produce more cheaply because our corn is subsidized with government funds. However, NAFTA removed the ability to place these tariffs, so it took that kind of democratic control out of the hands of Mexico. Consequently, the U.S. flooded their market with corn much more cheaply than could be produced there and essentially wiped out that industry entirely. So many of the small producers, you know, now produce things like marijuana, for example, which is a big cash crop, and other things. So that's just a simple example of how, you know, using public money and as well as this trade deal, corporate interests were able to seize an entire market in another country. And so that's essentially the sort of uses that NAFTA has had in terms of dominating markets with kind of monopoly control granted to them through these special rights and privileges to the detriment of working people there.
Steve Keen, that's an important point that Daniel Sankey is making. In 1994, when NAFTA was put into place, January 1st, 1994, the Zapatistas carried out an armed uprising in Chiapas in the southern part of Mexico. They said NAFTA will be a death sentence for Indian communities because it will drive corn growers out of business. And indeed, it did. Agribusiness from America was able to come in, undersell the corn that was produced by them, by those small farmers. The price was lowered. They drove the indigenous producers out of business. And then agribusiness raised the corn price. And so people couldn't live. And a lot of people started migrating to the United States. What we hear from Donald Trump is NAFTA is bad for American workers, but what Daniel Sankey is saying is it's bad for all workers.
Yeah, it's something which ends up basically making the working class, wherever it might be, beholden to the capitalists, wherever they might be. And certainly when you have a country like China, which goes through the same route, China is much more successful in capturing the gains of relocating production to its country, both for its workers and for its own, for generating its own capitalist class. I think the problem with the Mexican situation is that there's just not the same capacity of the Mexican working class to pressure their leaders into getting gains for them and also securing their situation against the arrival of American corporations, not just in manufacturing, of course, which is the main focus that Trump has, but in agribusiness, which is what's really hit the Mexican workers very, very hard. That didn't matter for China. There's no way agribusiness has turned up in the Chinese situation, and they've relocated people from working in the rural sector of China into the industrial sector to overall to their, in at least in financial and income benefits. But for the Mexicans, they got done, and it was only a small minority would have got jobs in the manufacturing sector compared to those who were displaced by agribusiness turning up there. So Trump is going to find in some ways the Mexicans at the working class level as angry about NAFTA as he is.
Daniel, last month, the U.S. Trade Representative Robert Lighthizer said, President Trump continues to fulfill his promise to renegotiate NAFTA and to get a much better deal for all Americans. Too many Americans have been hurt by closed factories, exported jobs, etc. Now, Lighthizer also made the point, quote, since NAFTA was implemented in 1994, the U.S. bilateral goods trade balance with Mexico has gone from $1.3 billion surplus to a $64 billion deficit in 2016. One, why did that happen? And two, who does it hurt? I mean, who are the winners and losers with those kind of numbers?
Yeah, definitely. So the reason why it happened was simply by destroying these barriers to trade, such as protective tariffs and labor regulations, the U.S. was able to outsource a great deal of its industrial production to Mexico and other countries. So these countries then started building up those industries and started producing all sorts of parts and other things that the industrial and agricultural sectors would produce. And then in return would sell them to the U.S. and we would purchase them. And this creates a trade deficit because we're not producing and exporting our own goods, but instead relying on the goods produced by other countries, in this case, Mexico, our deficit is increasing. We're importing more, we're exporting less. And so one of the results of that is the destruction of the manufacturing sector here in the U.S. Who this benefits, though, of course, is the corporations that have exported their production to these other countries. They're able to take advantage of weaker labor regulations, lower standard of living, which means, of course, wages are much lower, less of a standardization of kind of typical employee benefits that you might expect or see in the United States. And so this means that they can produce these things much more cheaply. And in many ways, the United States has become dependent on these cheap goods that are cheap and that allowed us to import both everything from simple working class people purchasing, you know, cheap goods at the grocery store all the way down the line to what industrial sector exists in America purchasing inputs to create different items here. So ultimately, it's really, you know, the corporations have benefited from this. Well, who haven't benefited is the workers who here in the U.S. have seen those jobs move overseas or over the border in the case of Mexico. And then they no longer have a skill set that's usable here. So really, that's been the benefit of it. You know, the Trump administration and others like to go on and on about this trade deficit. And I think for them to effectively address that, they're really going to have to take on the corporations who benefit from this. And given Trump's background and Trump's connections, I don't see that happening. I don't see him challenging them in this way. I think it's a lot of campaign rhetoric of him trying to sound like he's on the same page as the workers and going to fight for their rights. But in truth, I think a treaty as complicated as NAFTA, it's out of his league. I don't think he'll be able to negotiate it effectively. And moreover, I don't think he has the actual will to negotiate it to benefit workers. I think he'll continue to benefit corporate interests.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. We're speaking with from San Francisco by Daniel Sankey, a financial policy analyst, and from London by Steve Keen. He is the author of Debunking Economics. Steve Keen, how much is just rhetoric? In other words, trying to satisfy the promises, the campaign promises that Trump made. I mean, will this renegotiation have, one, any impact on American business? Two, and maybe more importantly for Donald Trump's base, will it have any positive impact on working folks here in the United States? In other words, will these jobs that have gone overseas start to come back?
Well, coming back to some extent because of manufacturing changes anyway. I mean, a lot of the advantage of outsourcing is because you've got a monumental drop in your wage costs, and it was worth the logistic costs on the other side to take advantage of that huge cut in wages. Now that we're seeing a lot of 3D manufacturing turning up and the capacity to actually produce those goods back on shore without a large amount of labor, the labor advantage is starting to disappear. So some of this manufacturing is coming back anyway because of that technological change. But of course, in doing so, it's not benefiting the workers who've been excluded, first of all, by the relocation and secondly, by the transfer across to much more machinery-based than labor-based production. So it's going to happen anyway. But I think after yesterday, with all the CEOs quite vividly turning on Trump and him turning back on them, I think you might see more of a, you might get more ability to interpret what's going to happen out of screw you type politics than out of any logical attempt to benefit his base.
What Steve Keen is referring to is U.S. President Donald Trump terminated the Manufacturing Council Initiative and Strategy and Policy Forum, two of the White House's earliest pushes following the exit of multiple chief executive officers wanting to create real distance from the president's reluctant condemnation of white supremacy. And now it's apparent embrace of white supremacy, his second comments. Trump tweeted, rather than putting pressure on the business people of the Manufacturing Council and strategy policy, I am ending both, Trump announced on Twitter Wednesday. So they laughed. They were unhappy that the president of the United States seems to be unable to distance himself from neo-Nazis, Daniel Sankey. And so he just says, okay, well, the hell with these two institutions that he created to make America great again.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, you know, the Trump administration has been in short supply of trusted advisors and skilled people, and now what little there were previously have left. NAFTA is very complicated. There's a lot of complexity to it that requires a very knowledgeable group of people to carefully negotiate it. There's going to be trade-offs. Different countries are going to want things in exchange for benefits to the United States. And there's going to be a lot of downstream effects. When you change one thing that might seem to immediately benefit the U.S., it might have the long-term effect of harming commerce here. Well, you're going to need some very skilled business people to help negotiate that. And he's, you know, ending the councils where he could gain access to those people. So, you know, I just don't see how he's going to be able to even negotiate this in an intelligent way or even understand it. I think understanding things has never stopped him from taking action or speaking, but I just don't see this happening. I don't think he's going to be able to do it. He's just lost so much credibility in their space. And, you know, these business interests were excited about being part of this council. They wanted to see if they could kind of have a comeback from the defeat of TPP in a renegotiation of NAFTA where they could have another opportunity to get favorable trade terms. And yet the Trump administration's, you know, just disgusting embrace, passionate embrace of white supremacy, they even couldn't, you know, stomach it. They felt that the fallout and the association with him and the PR nightmare was not worth it, even though they were getting another shot at beneficial trade agreements.
Okay, Steve King, we're going to give you the last word. We have about 90 seconds left. Donald Trump becomes radioactive even to the corporate executives. But let's go back to how this might now play out in NAFTA renegotiations. According to the BBC, Mexico's negotiators say they want to raise issues that include easing and clarifying migration rules for seasonal workers, better border infrastructure, and greater integration of telecom markets. It's not just going to be Mexico and Canada getting down on their knees in front of Donald Trump, especially under these particular political circumstances. Go ahead.
No, and I think it's quite possible he could basically say we're going to write NAFTA off and go back to effectively a customs union approach. So he could be quite blatant about this. And we're seeing more and more of his volatility. The more pressure he gets put under, the more he is to lash out, because one of the rules of a person suffering from narcissistic personality disorder, and I've got no doubt that's what his main defining feature of Donald Trump is, he never makes a mistake. He's always right. He always wins. So in these situations, if things become too contrary for him, he could simply say, that's it, I'm abolishing NAFTA. Now, that could be a really interesting headline for next week.
And given the way the headlines are breaking every day and every week, maybe we'll see it. Donald Trump, the art of the deal, not so much. Anyway, we're out of time. We've been joined from San Francisco by Daniel Sankey. He's a financial policy analyst. And from London by Professor Steve Keen. He's the author of Debunking Economics. If you want to support his work, you can go to patreon.com/Prof. Steve Keen. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. California became the first state to sue the Trump administration over its policy on sanctuary cities. The lawsuit was filed this past weekend. Jeff Sessions spoke today in Miami as part of the administration's hostile anti-immigrant policy. We are joined from Los Angeles by Juan Jose Gutierrez, the executive director of the Full Rights for Immigrants Coalition and a convener of the upcoming People's Congress of Resistance, which will take place at the Blackburn Center at Howard University on Saturday, September 16th and Sunday, September 17th. Welcome back, Juan Jose.
Thank you for inviting me, Brian.
Juan Jose, let's listen to our Attorney General, Jeff Sessions, speaking last month in Philadelphia, delivering a common anti-sanctuary city talking point. Let's listen, and then I want to get your response.
Unfortunately, however, and as we've built so many teams and partnerships and task forces around this country, this growing cooperation has been impeded by policies of certain states, cities, and counties. Some jurisdictions in this country refuse to cooperate with the federal government when it comes to immigration authorities to turn over illegal aliens who commit crimes, even MS-13 members. These policies are often called sanctuary policies.
All right. So there's the Attorney General, the man who can't stop hating immigrants, who also was so racist that the U.S., well, the Reagan administration pulled his proposed nomination for a federal district courtship back in the 1980s when it was revealed how personally racist he was against black people. He's been a longtime conservative senator from Alabama, and you have to be very conservative to be a conservative senator from Alabama. But Juan Jose Gutierrez, what's your reaction to Jeff Sessions? And he's talking about illegal aliens, MS-13, cities and counties blocking the government, blah, blah, blah. Go ahead.
Well, my reaction is that that statement is disgusting, outrageous, inhuman, and I mean, just pure, ugly racism. The Attorney General Sessions, in his statement, you know, he's talking about policies the cities and counties throughout the nation have adopted, whereby they refuse to cooperate in the enforcement of immigration law at the local level. But then he adds that even when undocumented persons are charged with heinous crimes and things of that nature, I mean, really serious crime. And then he throws in, to inflame the imagination of racists across the country, that he's talking specifically about gang members, like members of the Mara Salvatrucha and so on and so forth.
That's MS-13. That's who we're
talking about. Yeah, MS-13, right. And MS means, you know, Mara Salvatrucha, right? It's an abbreviation. So, I mean, that's pure racism. And it's an outrageous lie because sanctuary cities and governments in those cities that have enacted those policies of no cooperation in the enforcement of immigration law or cooperation with immigration authorities in enforcing immigration law have said very clearly that where serious crimes are involved, they will cooperate with immigration authorities. But where individuals are charged with a moving violation, so on, you know, minor offenses, you know, that they will not cooperate with authorities. And yet, Jeff Sessions confounds the listener by lying and saying that sanctuary cities and governments in them are refusing to cooperate in fighting serious crime, which is not the case. So just an outrageous, racist statement to persuade the public to support this racist policy, you know, that he's heading.
I mean, you're a grassroots organizer. You're in California. Of course, Southern California has just so many immigrants, documented and undocumented, from Mexico and Central America. But talk about and help the audience understand how the sanctuary movement began and how widespread it is, because it really has, within a few years, become a phenomenal achievement by the grassroots movement, so much so that it seems like many, many cities and states are now taking a sanctuary position.
That's correct, Brian. And, you know, what I would say is that in my view, the sanctuary city movement really started in California, which is known as a trendsetter, you know, back a political trendsetter for progressive policies back in 1994. Back in 94, we had a gubernatorial election, and Pete Wilson, who was our governor at the time, a very conservative and reactionary Republican politician, was way down in the polls. And his opponent happened to be Mrs. Brown, who happens to be the sister of our current state governor, Jerry Brown. And at that time, she had been the Secretary of Education, and she wanted to be governor. She was about 20 points ahead of Pete Wilson. So what happened is that Pete Wilson and the Republican Party devised a racist tool that went by the name of Proposition 187 that intended to deprive children of immigrants and most immigrants of any public services whatsoever. You know, they were going to be thrown out of school. They were going to, under that Proposition 187, that's how it was known, you know, they were going to turn teachers and doctors and nurses and so on into de facto immigration agents. So there was a major mass resistance in California against that proposition. You know, on October 16th of 94, we had hundreds of thousands of people that took to the streets to oppose racist Proposition 187 and racist Governor Pete Wilson. We lost the election, 59-41% in terms of gaining approval for Proposition 187. It was never implemented, and many, many people became very conscientious and politicized, and that set in motion a mass movement of resistance against racist anti-immigrant policies. And over time, the political views of the great majority of the people of California turned around, underwent a transformation, and started devising, you know, a progressive understanding of immigration, so much so that today California is at the forefront of opposing racist immigration policies against immigrants, to the point where California has introduced a bill to make the entire state of California a sanctuary state, which is taking it to the next level. We started talking about sanctuary cities, but California, with Senate Bill 54, has already passed it in the Senate. It's going to be voted on by the Assembly, and then the governor is going to have to decide whether or not he's going to sign it. But if that bill becomes law, California will be on record as the first state, and a major one, to basically say no to racism against immigrants, and yes to a policy of welcoming and protecting and safeguarding the interests of immigrants.
So as Jeff Sessions is announcing the Trump policy, the policy basically says if you declare yourself to be a sanctuary city, or maybe now a sanctuary state, meaning, again, just for the broader audience here, it means that when somebody gets stopped for a traffic light, or they ran a stop sign, or some minor infraction, like not criminal activity, stuff we all do, if that person is an immigrant, the local police are not going to say, show me your citizenship papers, or take them in and hold them to see if they are in fact citizens, which of course would have to be ethnic and racial profiling as well against Latinos. So that's basically what sanctuary means. We're not going to cooperate with those kind of policies, right?
Right. That's correct.
Okay. Now Sessions is saying, and Trump is saying, okay, then guess what? We're going to deprive you of money that would be used for public safety, for policing, et cetera, et cetera. The Washington Post, I want to read to you from an article, quote, from defiant lawsuits to reversing policies, U.S. cities and counties are zeroing in on their immigration rules to avoid losing millions in public safety dollars that the White House has threatened to withhold amid a high-stakes clash over sanctuary policies. Donald Trump has made it a top priority to revoke federal dollars from so-called sanctuary cities, broadly defined as places that limit cooperation with federal immigration authorities. Trump says he believes such cities and counties are providing a haven for criminal activity. Amid an executive order and almost weekly threats by the administration, cities and counties are fighting back. In other words, they're filing lawsuits. So what will happen? I mean, what actually happens now, Juan Jose, if these cities and towns, and many of them are starting to do it, file lawsuits, then the thing just gets frozen? Does, in the meantime, Trump withhold those dollars?
Trump definitely has the power to withhold the dollars from cities, counties, and states. You know, they have been receiving federal dollars to basically improve safety in their jurisdictions, in their communities. Now, of course, a judge can accept and allow restraining orders that could possibly obligate the federal government to release those funds while the lawsuits are pending and are being decided. So that's basically the mechanics of what we're going to be getting ourselves into now as a society, where progressive governments and progressive communities are going to be supporting the policy of protecting the rights and the integrity of immigrant communities. And Donald Trump and his racist, fascist government basically saying, no, you know, we need to clean house and we need to do ethnic cleansing any which way we can. And let's go after the weakest communities of working class people in America. And of course, the weakest bond there, you know, without a doubt, I would argue, are the undocumented immigrants.
Two California cities, Stockton and San Bernardino, were called out after expressing interest in the Justice Department's public safety partnership, which enlists federal agents and technology to find crime solutions. They were told they won't qualify unless they give federal immigration authorities access to jails and to notify agents before releasing inmates wanted on immigration violations. Talk about that, and how many people are we talking about in terms of impact?
Well, Riverside, it's the biggest county, not the most populated one in the state of California, but there are millions of people that live there. I would estimate maybe, you know, 2 to 3 million people. Stockton, I'm not sure, but we can take it a step further and say that that has caused enough concern across the state that State Attorney General Javier Becerra has filed a lawsuit already this week, Monday, I believe, against the Donald Trump administration, because you know, the state stands to lose $28 million to improve public safety across the state. And the basis of the lawsuit is that Donald Trump is wrong, the federal government is wrong, because you know, that policy of taking money away, federal dollars, from states, cities, and counties is unconstitutional. It's illegal because local law enforcement are not required to enforce immigration law. I mean, immigration is the sole responsibility of the federal government. And you know, it's ironic that it was precisely in Orange County back in April of 1996. We all saw it when two helicopters and people traveling in those helicopters were able to record a sheriff from Riverside County and highway patrolman basically pulled a pickup that was transporting on the highway undocumented persons and beat them up savagely. And, you know, Riverside County was infamous and still is for having a very conservative population where many Nazis and Ku Klux Klan members have been operating freely for decades. But, you know, because of the influx of Latino residents into that county, African-Americans, Asians, et cetera, progressive whites that, you know, that attend the University of Riverside and other educational institutions. The county is changing itself from a bastion of conservatism to a more progressive area. And so what we have now is that local governments are taking up the fight to defend undocumented persons, whereas only back in 1996, you know, their police forces were beating them up, abusing them, and cooperating with immigration authorities to deport them. So I think we've come a long way, and with this action by the attorney, the state attorney general, Javier Becerra, you know, confronting this racist immigration policy of the Donald Trump administration, where they're trying to take dollars away from California and by extension from many other states. You know, we're standing up and we're saying, hey, we're not going to allow that to happen in California. And hopefully that will become another trendsetter so that other progressive state governments across the nation decide not as cities or counties, but the entire state, you know, to go after the Donald Trump administration. I think we're on solid legal ground that taking federal dollars away from cities to improve public safety by local law enforcement is illegal, because it is unconstitutional, because enforcement of immigration law is the sole jurisdiction of the federal government.
Okay, that's the voice of Juan Jose Gutierrez. He's the executive director of the Full Rights for Immigrants Coalition. We're talking to him from Los Angeles. We have about a minute, maybe a minute and 20 seconds left, Juan Jose. Other cities are being sort of intimidated by the Trump administration. We have 1 minute left, actually. Baltimore city officials were baffled when they received an August letter saying they wouldn't qualify for a different federal anti-crime program. And the city hasn't even declared itself a sanctuary city. And city jails are run by the state of Maryland, not the city. So Baltimore faces a deadline to prove its case by Friday. Similarly, in Albuquerque, it has a pro-immigration policy, but it's not a sanctuary city. They're being deprived of funds. We have 40 seconds left. I mean, the Trump administration, all this talk about states' rights and local rights, that's all out the window right now.
That's all out the window. And let me just say that the situation with regards to sanctuary cities is not an easy one, because even in California, you know, we have a situation where right here where I'm based in Southern California, in the city of L.A., the city of L.A. has taken a very strong pro-immigrant rights position. And so the police chief, Charlie Beck, has said time and time again that there will be absolutely no cooperation in enforcement of immigration law by the Los Angeles Police Department with immigration authorities. On the other hand, the county sheriff, Jim McDermott, he has refused to do that. He says that those dollars are needed and that he does not support the concept or the idea of sanctuary cities, much less a sanctuary state. So the battle goes on.
The battle goes on. Let's leave it right there. We're talking with Juan Jose Gutierrez, executive director, the Full Rights for Immigrants Coalition in L.A. He's a convener of the upcoming People's Congress of Resistance, September 16th and 17th. At the Blackburn Center in Howard University. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. Now we're going to talk about the fight against Confederate and white supremacist monuments taking place all around the country. We are joined from Baltimore, Maryland by Dominique Stevenson. She's the program director for the American Friends Service Committee's Friend of a Friend program. And in studio by Walter Smolarek. He is a Sputnik News analyst, and he's also the producer of this show, Loud and Clear. Welcome, Dominique and Walter.
Thank you.
Good to be here.
The big news, Dominique, in the mainstream media, the corporate-owned media, is that the mayor ordered and the takedown of the Robert E. Lee and other Confederate monuments in Baltimore in the middle of the night last night. Talk about what happened and talk about how important that is.
Okay. Well, one, we think that they probably got wind of our plan. There was a coalition of activists and groups who today we were planning to take it down without their assistance and actually build on court. So I think they got wind of that plan and decided to beat us to the punch. There's no problem. We're glad that it's down. But the fact of the matter is the mayor of Baltimore needs to work harder on dismantling white supremacy, you know, in terms of economic development, in terms of the political system itself, and how oppressed black folks in Baltimore continue to be. Those monuments actually should have been down a long time ago. And it's like, I'm not willing to give up much credit to the city for doing it. They're doing it because it's trendy. You're seeing this happen all over. But I do also believe that they got wind of the plan, and that was the urgency of doing it in the middle of the night.
Indeed. I mean, the whole thing is very, I mean, the fact that Robert E. Lee Memorial and other Confederate memorials and monuments are in Baltimore. Maryland, although a slave state during the Civil War, fought against the Confederacy. In 1864, by referendum, the state of Maryland abolished slavery because Maryland hadn't been included in the Emancipation Proclamation. And it was the Maryland soldiers in the Union Army whose absentee ballots by 90% made the difference in that referendum. In other words, they had experienced the war in the Deep South and they were voting to end slavery. And then here's the city of Baltimore and so many other places in northern states, even like Montana, here in Washington, D.C., Confederate monuments. Talk about why the monuments even exist.
I think that they existed and they came at a time when people were romanticizing the Civil War. And I think people have always romanticized the South's role in the Civil War. People talk about it as a lost cause, and I'm like, no, it was simply losing. I think that it also was a clear representation of white supremacy, and for black folks to have to see those symbols. I mean, you look at New Orleans, where you have Jefferson Davis Boulevard and what became a largely black community, and you had a statue of Jefferson Davis there for folks to be confronted with every day of their life. You know, those things are they're actually not remnants of white supremacy. To me, it just demonstrates how prevalent white supremacy continues to be in this country. They are simply symbols. I'm like, we have to do the work to really dismantle the system that continues to keep so many people locked out. It's not just white supremacy. We're talking about capitalism as well.
Indeed. I hear you on that. Walter, same question to you. I mean, here you had the South technically losing the Civil War. And yet 30 years later in the 1890s and then in the 1910s, the 1920s, the 1930s, the Southern cause became the cause. In other words, there was the slave owner's interpretation of the Civil War. Talk about these monuments, their origin. Go ahead.
Right. I mean, even though, you know, we could say that capitalism became the dominant system in the United States after the end of slavery in the South, right? The system of white supremacy remained constant from that transition to slavery to capitalism. And so, you know, these are monuments to white supremacy. I mean, one of the so-called Confederate monuments in Baltimore that was taken down was actually not of like a Confederate general. It was Justice Taney, who was the Supreme Court judge who was responsible for the Dred Scott decision. I mean, the most disgusting Supreme Court ruling in the history of this country.
And why? Why is it?
So that's when the Supreme Court determined that black people were not human beings, but that they were property. And so it was the law of the land. The Supreme Court said under Taney's leadership, like that is how it is in the United States of America. And there was a statue of this person in Baltimore, in a historically black city. It's just so disgusting. And it shows, you know, just like Dominique was saying, that, you know, the system of white supremacy continues to exist. It's not just a relic of the past. It didn't just exist in the southern states that seceded from the United States. It's a reminder that this is still the same fundamental social order that capitalism is so dependent on.
Dominique and Walter, I want to play a short audio clip. It's from yesterday. It's Donald Trump. Now infamous press conference where he doubled down on, quote, blaming both sides for the events in Charlottesville. The day before, he read a prepared statement. Somebody wrote it for him where he sort of blandly denounced Nazism or racism and said it was evil. But then here was Donald Trump speaking off the cuff. And this is the real, real Donald Trump, who I think we can see by his comments that his heart is with the white supremacists. Let's listen to it.
So, you know, as far as I'm concerned, that was a horrible, horrible day. Wait a minute. I'm not finished. Fake news. That was a horrible day. I will tell you something. I watched those very closely, much more closely than you people watched it. And you have you had a group on one side that was bad, and you had a group on the other side that was also very violent. And nobody wants to say that, but I'll say it right now. You had a group on the other side that came charging in without a permit, and they were very, very violent.
Dominique, Donald Trump is really talking about the anti-racists. That's who he really means, is the violent forces. In fact, they were protecting people against the Klan, now reincarnated as the alt-right. Go ahead.
It's interesting even to bring up Taney in the Dred Scott decision, because it gets back to right, you know, and it didn't start with Taney, but he certainly put it into words that black folks have no rights that white people are bound to respect. It's the same thing. People, I'm, you know, assuming that what Trump is saying is we have no right to protect folks. We have no right to protect ourselves. We have no right to even be opposed to the institution of white supremacy. And actually, the funny thing about all of this is our initial target was going to be the Taney statue. We decided to pull down the other one because it would have been a lot easier. But they're both gone, so that's good.
Yes. And today, Walter, we have the memorial for Heather Heyer. She was killed by a white supremacist as he drove his car with murderous intent, obviously, into a big crowd of peaceful people, the anti-racist protesters. Donald Trump doesn't seem to be that bothered by all of that. Where's it all go right now? I mean, obviously, when Trump is talking like this, the alt-right, so-called, the really, let's call them what they are, fascist, Nazis, KKK, white supremacists, they feel emboldened because they feel like, hey, it's our time. Our time has come. We can come out of the closet. And yet the mass movement against racism and against white supremacy is also growing. 7,000 people showed up at our demonstration here on Sunday. Go ahead.
Yeah, and I was in Philadelphia just following the Charlottesville rally and terrorist attack. And, you know, there was a demonstration within, you know, a pretty large demonstration within just a few hours of what happened. So I think people are responding all over the country. Of course, you know, there's the massive funeral for Heather Heyer, the martyr, the hero who was with the anti-racist protesters, but murdered by the white supremacist, the neo-Nazi, who rammed into the crowd with his car. And, you know, there are many, many martyrs in the struggle against the Klan, against white supremacy for, you know, centuries in U.S. history. And she joins that tradition. You know, the alt-right, I think, the neo-Nazis, whatever label we want to affix to them, they do feel energized. I think that, you know, there's a crisis in the system. They're trying to present themselves as, you know, the most resolute people, the people with the answers to the problems facing white people. And so because of they're being enabled by Donald Trump, by many, many other racist politicians, you know, I think that it's going to be a threat that will be here for quite some time. But of course, we have to keep in mind that the anti-racist forces, the progressives, we are many, many, many times larger than they are. And if we continue to mobilize in large numbers and confront the racist like they did in Charlottesville, I think that we can make it very, very clear that they are marginal and they can be defeated.
Dominique, you had mentioned that the monuments are symbols of racism, symbols of white supremacy, but the institutions of white supremacy and racism are fundamental, in fact, to U.S. capitalism. And U.S. capitalism is becoming more and more polarized and more divided, income inequality growing. The eight richest people in the world have the equivalent wealth of 3.5 billion people. In other words, the immiseration at the bottom, the growing luxury at the top. So the struggle against white supremacy is interlinked with and connected with the struggle against capitalism itself. Talk about how that manifests in a city like Baltimore, which was formerly an industrial city, a lot of jobs. Poverty has always been there, but it's deeply, you know, it's increasing gravely right now. Talk about what it's like there.
Yeah. Right now, it feels like we're returning to that period in the early 1990s where the rate of homicide was off the charts. A lot of that due to the drug trade, due to the infighting and the war that go on because of the drug trade, which happens to be probably the only industry in some of our communities. You know, since the 1970s, we've lost significant industrial jobs. And you also saw a spike in the growth of the number of people going to prison. The community that we work in here in Sandtown, Winchester, has like the highest incarceration rate in the entire state. There's also the community where Freddie Gray was detained and beaten and later died from that beating. So it's coupled with that kind of aggressive policing where everybody is basically locked down in that community. And it's not getting any better. You know, at some point, the pressure is going to give. That was represented, I think, in the spring of 2015 when young people rose up. I think without some degree of relief, economic relief, you know, the condition is going to get worse. But I don't know how much more people can take. I don't know how much more they can bend here.
Yeah, there were a lot of reports, Dominique, about the Charlottesville police doing nothing to separate the Nazis on Friday night, carrying torches and then beating up people from the Black Lives Matter movement, carrying weapons, including assault weapons, the next day. The police were sort of conspicuously absent so that the fascists could actually try to engage in violence. And a lot of people thought, well, okay, that's Charlottesville police. Maybe a lot of the cops are actually sympathizers with the Nazis. What's it like in Baltimore? Because we did have the Freddie Gray killing, and it's quite obvious that the way the policing happened with Freddie Gray was not that unusual. And we also know that the cops were acquitted. So how do people in the Black community in Baltimore feel about Baltimore police?
Okay, it would be hard for me to say that I speak for all Black folks, but generally the Black folks I encounter and work with don't have any regard for them. We see them as a terrorist force because a lot of times that's what they're coming into the community doing. They're inflicting some level of terrorism on us, whether it's, you know, executing raids that frighten and traumatize our children, whether it's beating. That beating was the one that just happened to have rose to the level of national attention. It's not like there hasn't been a history of people beaten and or killed by the police here in Baltimore. And so there's no trust. You can't build that kind of trust with a force that has been essentially treating you as if you are an enemy combatant. You know, the other thing, too, when we talk about fascism, I include the police in that. Because to me, that's how it gets played out in our community. They're essentially like a fascist force that can beat you at will, that can lock you up at will, that can do whatever they choose to do.
Yeah, Walter, police in Baltimore and, in fact, all around the country have a license. Well, they're the only part of society that's licensed to carry firearms and use them against the civilian population. So they have this tremendous authority. I mean, they can carry guns and use them against us, against the civilian population. And they're, as Dominique is making the point, the Black communities and Latino communities especially are being super policed, like an occupation force, and they can kill people. And then once in a while, there's a charge of manslaughter or whatever, but the police are rarely ever convicted. And then if they are convicted, the convictions are overturned. Why is it that the system, meaning the real powers in America, tolerate this? Is this what they want?
I think it is what they want. I think it's essential for them to keep a hold over their system, this, you know, extreme militarized policing, which is, you know, always been the case with policing. It's always been a military force, but there's been a clear escalation in the, you know, their access to high-tech equipment, the sheer number of them that are on the streets, the vehicles that they have access to. I think all of this is symptomatic of, you know, what we were talking about earlier with like the decline of industry in Baltimore, which of course has taken place in cities and towns across the country. You know, their system is not like it used to be. And while they, and by they, I mean, you know, the elites, you know, the true ruling political establishment, while their lives have gotten better, their lives are great, the immiseration, the level of misery in the rest of society has gotten so deep over the last few decades that they need this massive complex of police, of the quote-unquote justice system, so the courts, the prisons, That's why they have this whole apparatus, which I think the KKK, the neo-Nazis, they're sort of the advance guard.
Dominique Stevenson, we have less than 1 minute. I'm going to give you the final word. Go ahead.
Hate white supremacy on all levels. Let's bring this stuff down. We can turn this thing around.
So you're optimistic?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's important because without optimism and without people feeling that what they do matters and can make change, it leads to passivity and thus things don't change. But it can change. We've seen it change over time. But of course, it is a fierce, fierce struggle. We've been joined from Baltimore by Dominique Stevenson. She's a program director for the American Friends Service Committee's Friend of a Friend program. And in studio by Walter Smolarek, Sputnik News analyst. Well, that's all the time we have. We'll be back tomorrow. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We are out of here.
Loud and Clear.